see, this is lecture number 4 in our course on ethics, and we're going to be finishing up abortion, and if we have time, we'll begin to discuss euthanasia and infanticide. We gave some biblical arguments against abortion and in support of the pro-life movement. Oh, let me give you your Bible back. Now we want to look at some of the medical. We want to look at some of the medical evidence against abortion, which of course is the evidence that life starts at the moment of conception. There's several doctors that are listed by Dr. Norman Geisler, and they're on page 149 of his text. If you have the textbook there, you might want to take a look at it. And he gives some of their testimony. There's a doctor, Michelin M. Matthews Roth, a Dr. Jerome Lejeune, and a Dr. Jaime Gordon. And these are from their testimonies before a 1981 U.S. congressional hearing about when life starts. And when you look at these, like the quote from Jerome Lejeune, he was that guy that I talked about too, where his court testimony about a different matter, about the freezing of embryos, where he referred to them as human beings, that whole documentation, you can get his entire testimony there in that R.C. Sproul book. But Jerome Lejeune says here, to accept the fact, and by the way, Jerome Lejeune is the guy that he discovered Down syndrome. He's one of the world's leading genetic experts. It says, to accept the fact that after fertilization has taken place, a new human has come into being is no longer a matter of taste or opinion. The human nature of the human being from conception to old age is not a metaphysical contention. It is plain experimental evidence. Okay? Dr. Michelin M. Matthews Ross says, in biology and in medicine, it is an accepted fact that the life of any individual organism reproducing by sexual reproduction begins at conception or fertilization. Break it down into layman's terms, it takes a mommy and a daddy and they make a baby, not some magic wand or something that occurs 9 months later. It's the sperm and the egg make a new human being. Dr. Jaime Gordon says, but now we can say unequivocally that the question of when life begins is no longer a question for theological or philosophical dispute. It is an established scientific fact. Theologians and philosophers may go on to debate the meaning of life or the purpose of life, but it is an established fact that all life, including human life, begins at the moment of conception. Now, these are the testimonies from the world's leading experts that our congressmen heard. So, our congressmen know better. Has anybody here ever seen photos? Remember, we're aborting babies during the whole 9 months. Has anybody seen photos of babies that have been aborted at like 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 months? I mean, those are human beings. Those are human beings that are torn apart. And I do not take those, you know, I've got in my own television program, my local television program, I'm not, when I do a program on abortion, I'm not going to hold up the picture and send, 3,000 kids screaming to their psychologists and stuff like that. So I don't flaunt those things, but you cannot look at that and honestly say that that is not a human being. There is a little baby there, and we've got to stick up for and protect these little children. But the medical and scientific expert witnesses, not all of these guys and gals were pro-life. Some of them were pro-abortionists. But they're at least honest to admit, yeah, we are killing unborn babies, but they are human beings. That's what I'm saying. When you get it to the intellectual level, the leaders at the forefront of this movement openly admit, oh yeah, human life starts at conception. When else is it supposed to start? I mean, you know, man and a woman come together and they make a baby boy or a baby girl. But, you know, we don't believe that God exists, so we can play God, so we can determine who has the right to live and who doesn't have the right to live. And I think it'd be a lot better world if we just started killing these babies before they're born. That's the way the argument runs on the intellectual level, but you're not going to hear that from the press because there's a lot of double speak going on. There's a lot of propaganda that's going on. And most of the people in the lower echelon of the pro-abortion movement are sincere, but they're sincerely wrong, but they don't even realize that the people at the forefront openly admit that these are human beings that are being killed. But a new human life begins when a male cell and female cell encounter to produce the next generation at the moment of conception, which is the initial stage of human life. We mentioned before Dr. Bernard Nathanson, one of the original pro-abortion leaders. He's performed thousands of abortions, and now he recognizes that life begins at conversion, and he is now pro-life. Now, I don't know where he stands religiously, but for at least the first year after he became pro-life, he was still very, very anti-Christian. But he just came to the conclusion from the medical evidence that life starts at conception and we got to stop killing unborn babies, even though at that point he was still an atheist even. There have been babies who have survived lots of abortions. You know, if a baby survives a botched abortion, were they not human beings when the abortion was attempted? I mean, are we going to say, well, a botched abortion makes tissue into a live human being? You know, that's, I don't think anybody can argue that. Also, the slippery slope argument sometimes gets some good slippery slopes that this is going to lead to this, this is going to lead to that. Dr. Francis Schaeffer wrote about this. He said, abortion is going to lead to infanticide and euthanasia, and I think he's been right. It's headed in that direction. But abortion leads to infanticide and euthanasia. In the 1980s, baby Jane Doe was a baby born with Down syndrome. You know, it used to be that we felt in this country that if somebody had Down syndrome, they just need extra love. But instead, what the Indiana Supreme Court ruled, they allowed the doctor and the parents to starve the baby to death, and the baby, it took 12 days for the baby to starve to death, and the baby's only crime, you know, the people who back this are usually the same people who were backing Ted Bundy's right to life, that he should not be executed. You know, they protect a ruthless serial killer, but then you're allowed to starve a baby to death, and the baby's only crime, the baby was born with Down syndrome. But that baby died. It took 12 days to die. I don't know if it was 12 days, if it was 12 days old when the baby died, or if she was, if it was 12 days after the ruling. So I don't think the baby would even last that long if it was after the ruling. Francis Crick, he won the 1962 Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine, along with James D. Watson and Maurice Wilkins, for breaking the DNA code. So these guys are experts on genetics, okay? And they won the Nobel Prize in 1962 for physiology and medicine because of it. Crick stated in 1978, so this is no fly-by-night guy, this is one of the leading men in his field. Crick stated in 1978, no newborn infant should be declared human. This is a baby already born. No newborn infant. Again, these are the guys at the forefront of the movement. These are the intellectuals that are leading this type of thing, not the followers that we deal with on a regular basis. Most politicians are just followers, by the way. They're not the intellectuals leading the way. But Francis Crick stated in 1978, no newborn infant should be declared human until it has passed certain tests regarding its genetic endowment, and that if it fails these tests, it forfeits the right to life, the right to live. That's the kind of things that these people are saying. See, the thing is, the intellect was recognized as a human being before birth, but let's kill it anyway. So then when the baby's born, what's to stop us from killing it as if it doesn't fit our master race or our what we feel is a perfect human being? Why not declare it non-human after? I mean, it's like they're saying, well, look, we don't believe that God exists, therefore we've randomly declared that the unborn child is not a human being until birth. Why don't we just randomly declare that it's not a human being until later on? And we'll just watch it, make sure it doesn't have any defects. If it's got some defects, we'll just kill the baby. Watson, who also won the Nobel Prize with him, he said, and Francis Schaeffer quotes his words, but he basically stated that the newborn shouldn't be declared alive until 3 days after birth. And that way we could weed out a lot of medical expenses and stuff like that by weeding out the ones that don't fit in our definition of what a perfect human being should be. So he's saying, we randomly said they're not alive until they're born. Hey, we know there's an ounce of medical evidence to back that. Let's just say they're not legal, they don't have any legal right to life 3 days after they're born. See, the debate on the intellectual level is not when does human life start. The intellectual know, if they're informed on this area, in this area, they know it starts at conception. The debate is about when does a human being have the legal right to life. Well, as far as the Bible would be concerned, every human being has the right to life unless you forfeit it through murdering somebody else. But as far as these guys are concerned, we don't believe there's God, so we can play God, we can just say, and we can decide who lives and who dies. So that's the medical arguments. It's our biblical arguments, medical arguments. Now here's some constitutional arguments. Declaration of Independence, written in 1776. Our founding fathers stated, you know, 15 years before the Constitution, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. I heard a guy giving an excellent speech once, and he mentioned that our founding fathers gave us the right to life, and gave us the right to pursue happiness, and that therefore we shouldn't let these liberals out there take these rights from us. He totally misunderstood our founding fathers. Our founding fathers never claimed to give us the right to life, liberty, or pursuit of happiness. They said they were inalienable rights. As human beings, we automatically have them. So if you medically prove that human life starts at the moment of conception, then the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, you have that from the moment of conception. They're inalienable rights. That means you can't, just being human, you have them. They're God-given, and man can't take them away. Now you can, a government can violate those rights, can ignore those rights, but you can't say, no, the guy has that right. They're inalienable. They can't be taken from him. If the guy's a human being or if the gal's a human being, they've got those rights and they can't be taken away from them. But they're endowed with their prayer with certain inalienable rights that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The 14th Amendment to the Constitution guaranteed the rights of life, liberty, and property to all human beings. Well, if medical science has shown that life starts at the moment of conception, then lo and behold, our Constitution should therefore say that even the unborn has the right to life. And then in historical arguments, so this dates way back to the Code of Hammurabi, the 18th century BC legal code, forbid even unintentional causing of a miscarriage. So even if a woman was careless and that caused a miscarriage, that was forbidden. The law of Moses in 16th century BC, we show that a death penalty for causing the death of an unborn baby. In Persia in the 12th century BC, they punished women who caused themselves to abort. The Greek physician, I believe it's pronounced his name Hippocrates, I know it's the Hippocratic Oath, I believe it's pronounced Hippocrates, The Greek physician made an oath not to give an abortive remedy to any woman. He said, as a doctor, I'm here to save life, I'm not here to take life, you will not abort babies. Now that Hippocratic oath, a modern version of that, was once spoken by our doctors. Now what they did since 1973, they just removed the phrase about not giving a woman an abortive remedy and inducing an abortion. So the Hippocratic oath, which was taken by physicians for years upon years, they just removed the part about abortion and acted like it was never there. The Epistle of Barnabas, a Christian writing that was written between 70 and 140 AD, we're not really sure if Barnabas really did write it, but there, the early Christians there, between 70 and 140 AD, were very outspoken against abortion. The Apostolic Fathers, the compilation of writings of the Apostolic Fathers contains the Epistle of Barnabas in there. Augustine in the 4th century AD, Aquinas in the 13th century AD, and Calvin in the 16th century AD all considered abortion unethical and considered it wrong, though there were different degrees in their views. I believe Aquinas did not believe that life started at the moment of conception, but just being a potential life, in his view, was enough to make it unethical, though it probably wouldn't have been viewed as murder, but I'd have to look into that. English common law and early American law also forbid abortion. We are not screaming, we are not a bunch of Christian fanatics screaming for something new. What we are arguing for is that we should get rid of this new thing that came into the picture in 1973. This is abortion being legalized throughout America is what, 31 years old? No, 21 years old. Yeah, 21 years old. I don't know where I've been at in 30, but it's 21 years old. That's new. And what we're saying is we should go back to the traditional view that abortion is wrong, and in most cases throughout history was considered murder. The question then comes up to close our study on abortion, and then we'll go into euthanasia and infanticide. What about when the mother's life is at stake? Okay? I do not hold the view that automatically, when the mother's life is at stake, you automatically abort the baby. I do not think that is right, because what we're really saying there is human life outside the womb is more valuable than human life inside the womb, and I don't think we want to do that and start playing the game of determining whose life has more value, the older person, the younger person, and start playing games like that. I think that both the unborn and the mother must be considered human. Both the unborn and the mother must be considered human. And if the doctor makes a professional, in his professional opinion, if the doctor cannot save both, the question should be, which one does he have the best chance to save? It's the illustration I would give is like a firefighter in a burning building, and the building is really going up in flames, and he only has time to save one person. He's got one time to make one trip in and one trip out, and that's it. He only has time to save one person. He hears screams coming from two different rooms and two different sides of the house. The ethical thing to do would not be like maybe Roman Catholicism, what would say in certain instances where just to come out of the house, you know, as far as when they deal with abortion, you try to save both, and if you can't save both, no, it's the baby. They always shoot the baby. The choice is pre-made, is what it is, but I think they always choose the baby. That's the choice that is made, so if it's either-or situation, they always go with the baby, so the mother is always doomed to death in those situations. But with this firefighter, he must try to save at least one. That's the ethical thing to do. Nobody is going to slam him for only saving one, not the other, but we would hope that he's going to make his decision in a professional manner on which he thinks which person's voice that he hears, which person he thinks he has the best shot at saving. And, there might be a case where to save the life of the mother, there might be only a 2% chance, whereas if they try to save the life of the baby, it might be a 45 or 50% chance of saving the baby. I don't know. I'm not a doctor. But I think those are the kind of things that got to be weighed, considering both as human beings, both with the equal right to life. And I think we're inconsistent when we just say automatically you say one or the other. And you know, I don't know if these how close to reality the hypothetical situation I just presented is there. Right now we're going to move on to euthanasia. Euthanasia. Whole lot of information here too. Euthanasia means mercy killing or good death. And mercy killing is what euthanasia is supposed to be. And infanticide is the killing of infants already born. Okay, that's what makes it different from abortion. But there's four main types, well, two main types of euthanasia. And then there's some subdivisions, there's two subdivisions of one of the two types. But there is active euthanasia. Active euthanasia. And then there's passive euthanasia. Now, active euthanasia, is the act of taking a life to avoid suffering. Okay? What was that movie, Sand Pebbles or something? It was Steve McQueen, where he's up on the boat, he's with the Navy, and his buddy, who was an Oriental, I don't know if he was Japanese or what, and the people were torturing him, they had tied to a stake and were torturing him, and he was under orders that he was not allowed to go down to help the guy, and I don't know if the boat was moving off to sea or whatever, he was a Navy ship and all. Anyway, his buddy was screaming, so eventually he took a weapon, one of the rifles, off from one of the other Navy guys, Steve McQueen, and he shot his buddy to kill him to save him agony. And when you see a guy, your best friend, in a whole lot of pain and stuff like that, we're not saying, again, we've got to have compassion either. It's a tough situation, especially in war. If you see your buddy all blown to pieces and he's still hanging in and he's screaming to you to shoot him, these are tough issues, and we've got to have a certain amount of compassion and not speak as if we're perfect ourselves. These are tough dilemmas at times. But that would be a case of active euthanasia, where you're actively doing something to put the person to death, to put them out of their quote-unquote misery. The act of taking of a life to avoid suffering. My understanding, and I believe Geisler agrees with me on this, this is always, active euthanasia is always wrong. It's always the taking of innocent human life. Okay? And believe me, I could see myself being very tempted. I was in the Marine Corps for 3 years in the Marine Corps. I could see myself very tempted if one of my Marine Corps buddies was laying there with both his legs blown off, bleeding to death, and screaming to me to shoot him. Now, but I will also say this. I've come pretty close to doing that when I get a bad headache. I'm such a big baby that the pain gets so bad, it's almost like, you know, I wish I knew somebody who would just shoot me because I don't have the guts to do it myself. But then 10 minutes later, you know, pop a couple aspirin, the headache goes away, and I start thinking to myself, well, what a baby I was. But, you know, there's sometimes, a guy breaks up with a girl, a 15-year-old guy, and this 15-year-old girlfriend breaks up with him and he wants to kill him, doesn't want to go on living. By the time he's 15 and a half, he can't even remember the girl's name. So there's certain times when we really want to die and we're begging for a favor, but we need to recognize the people who make decisions in those areas like that, sometimes the person who's bleeding all over the place does not have the greatest judgment at that time. But active euthanasia, you are doing the killing. You are actively doing the killing in active euthanasia. So, active euthanasia is always murder and it's always wrong. as rough as the circumstances can be, and as much as I can sympathize with people in some of those areas, it is always murder, it is always wrong, okay? That's where you actively take measures to end the life. You know, it'd be like a lethal injection. I remember seeing that cartoon in one of, what is his name, John? Is it John Whitehead that had the Rutherford Institute? Anyway, one of his books, there's a cartoon in there, and the guy's got to hold up a needle, and he's getting ready to inject his mother, who's laying down in bed, and his mother's in a rage and screaming at him, and the guy's holding a newspaper behind his back, and the headline says, Congress legalizes lethal injection for the elderly. So he's getting ready to hit his mother with a lethal injection, and his mother's laying down in bed in a rage, and she's looking at him, and she's shaking, and she's screaming at him, and she says something like, Harry, I knew you would be no good. I knew I should have aborted you when you were born. But you know, that's the kind of society we're living in right now. If mom doesn't get the son before the son's born, that son might grow up and not want to be bothered with mom when mom gets older, and he might get her later on. And you know, it's a situation where the love of mankind has grown cold, and we got fathers against mothers, and the whole situation there. But anyway, that's active euthanasia. Now, passive euthanasia is allowing death to occur to avoid suffering. Okay? Allowing death to occur to avoid suffering. So, you neglect to do something that you could have done to either prolong life or really prolong death. But we'll talk about that. But there's two kinds here. There's unnatural, passive euthanasia, and there's also natural. Passive euthanasia. By the way, I think every pastor should have a course. Every pastor or wannabe pastor should have a course in this, because you get hit with this stuff a lot. I was at the deathbed of a lady. I think I was a pastor at the time, but she wasn't coming to my church, but she was coming to a Bible study I was teaching. And so I went to her deathbed, and they were talking about they were going to be pulling the plug, and I thought it was one of these big ethical dilemmas. And so I was thinking, oh man, what do guys will say here? What do guys will say here? But it turned out it was just doctors have been doing that for years on a regular basis, pulling the plug in certain instances where there's no legal debate on it, just good medical judgment. And what those cases are is natural passive euthanasia. Okay? You see, first, let's cover unnatural passive euthanasia, which is basically negligent homicide. You didn't do something you could have done. You had the means available. You could have done something to save the life, but instead, you just through negligence, you don't do anything, and the person dies. Unnatural passive euthanasia is negligent homicide. It is murder. It is allowing death by deliberately withholding natural means of sustaining life. Natural means would be such things as food, water, or air. If we have the means to feed someone in a coma intravenously, you know, years ago, if you were in a coma and you were going to be in a coma for 75 or 80 days, you were going to die. Okay? Doesn't mean it gives anybody the right to kill them, but it just means you're going to die and you're going to starve to death. Well, nowadays we have the means to feed these people. And when we start saying, well, it's too expensive, then we're putting price tags on human life. We were created in God's image. We can't be doing that. Human life is priceless. So unnatural passive euthanasia is allowing death by deliberately withholding natural means of sustaining life. Natural means such as food, water, and air. And so the person would die of starvation when we had the ability to feed them, or the person dies of suffocation when we had the ability to get them there. In other words, unnatural path of euthanasia, they die an unnatural death because we had the means to take care of them. Okay? So it's unnatural. In other words, This guy isn't dying because of the disease he's got. He's dying because you withheld food from him. He isn't dying because he's got cancer or some other disease. He's dying because you withheld air from him. Okay, you understand what that is? This is unnatural. If you would have intervened, he would have lived. Now, natural passive euthanasia, which is morally justified, these are in cases of irreversible diseases where the person, they got a lethal disease, they're going to die, and you decide to withhold unnatural life-sustaining equipment. Okay? And then, so you decide to pull the plug on this machine or that machine, and the person dies. What kills them is the irreversible disease, not that they didn't get food, water, or air. Okay? So it's the decision not to prolong death rather than the decision to kill. Okay? In other words, the irreversible, with this lady, the cancer was eating her apart, and all they were doing on this machine was prolonging it maybe for a few extra hours or whatever. So just taking her off the machine would just allow the inevitable death to kill her, and she would die not because we withheld water, air. By the way, this type of thing has been done. The court never even intervened in the situation. That's just a good professional opinion. It's like we've done everything we can do. This person is going to die from this disease. Rather than prolong their agony, let's just take away these extra things that are keeping them prolonging their death. Yeah.
How do you deal with people that are like good solid Christians supposed to be that are totally in favor of Jack the Ripper?
You're talking about the Gavorkian?
Yeah.
There was a joke going about him that he was, David Letterman, somebody told me, I don't watch David Letterman, but somebody told me, I think it was him, somebody told me that he said something about, you know your boss doesn't like you when they send you for a physical and the company physician turns out to be Dr. Kevorkian, but that guy is actually, he's in the realm of active euthanasia.
Yeah.
I mean, he is just actively killing people, and half of these people don't even have terminal diseases. They've got some kind of pain that's real rough, makes life rough, and they just want to die. And doctors were supposed to help in the healing process of man. You never want to give another human being license to kill innocent people.
So the cost of that, and maybe more and more Christians are fully supportive for everybody's human life.
I would take the notes from a course like this and talk with them, but what amazes me about the Christian church today is how much pride we have in our ignorance. We are so proud. We are so proud that we don't even know what the atheist philosophy professor is talking about, and we take pride in our ignorance. And again, like I said earlier in today's sermon, if God didn't want us to use our minds, then he had no business getting the Apostle Paul to write half of the New Testament. Like I say too, I read a lot of guys who wrote about Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, and there is more agreement about their teachings than there is about the Apostle Paul. Paul's teachings were so complex, especially when you get to Romans 9, that you can get 50 theologians in a room, and they'll come up with 50 different interpretations of what he's talking about, because his thought is so complex. It's so complex that even Peter has to warn people, when you read him, watch out, because uneducated guys pull his passages out of context and teach all kinds of heresies. We're supposed to do some thinking. Unfortunately, the church today will, a lot of Christians today will make life and death decisions without even spending 5 minutes investigating the factors that are involved. And we also, that's like Bill Clinton is going so far out of his way to win the evangelical vote, when as far as the statistics that I saw, the evangelical Christians didn't vote any differently than the world did. And and I tend to think that there's some real good reasons for not voting for Bill Clinton. And But the fact is, we think it was weak. The Christian church in America today is conformed to the world standards. I mean, we walk like them, we talk like them, we, you know, right down the line. And I'm the guy who's preaching from the pulpit, we need to spend more time with the people of the world. Because the average Christian, 2 years after he's saved, has no friends, no close friends who are non-believers. So the only way your church grows is if you steal from other churches in the area. We need to get out there where the non-believers are. And we need to be like Jesus, get out there with these people and get them the gospel. At the same time, we impact their lives rather than allow them to conform our lives. But it is really, on a regular basis, people try to make me feel guilty for trying to find reasons to persuade people that Christianity is true. When all this evidence is out there, a debate of philosophy professor at Lower Columbia College, blow him away, which Bertrand Russell didn't do any better against Copleston. Anthony Flew didn't do any better when he debated Dr. Habermas, one of my professors. Now we want to debate creation versus evolution. None of the guys will take the debate. None of their science professors. So now we have to just go in there and just present our side all by ourselves because no one will debate from that particular school. Yet, the reason why I'm going there is because the students in that particular school were begging Farriston to get somebody in here to debate these issues because they keep making fun of the students, saying you can't be an intelligent man in the 20th century and still believe God exists. Well, if you can't, well then how come if I'm such a jackass and such an idiot, how come their philosophy professors can't be in a debate in that particular issue? But that's, I've got to comment, my biggest enemies in this area our fellow Christians, they're the ones who say I'm not supposed to think. The world expects us to think and find evidence for what we believe in. But Christian brothers and sisters, and so they make decisions like that, life and death, Ann Apple is, should they pull the plug or not? And Ann Apple is over there. And I tell you, too, when it's going to cost, if you don't have insurance, it's going to cost $87,000 a year or $87,000 a month to keep this lady alive, the easiest answer is, hey, pull the plug. She lived a good long life and she'll be with Jesus. She's a believer and stuff like that. But this is human life. We're not talking about going out and shooting a horse. We're running a little low on time. But I hope we see the distinction between the two. The reason why this one is okay, natural path of euthanasia, is because they die of natural causes. It's the disease that kills them, not the fact that Phil Fernandez decided he didn't want to pay for the intravenous feeding of Grandpa so-and-so. The disease killed him. Francis Schaeffer turned down chemotherapy. Didn't want it. Nothing wrong with that whatsoever. He died naturally of his cancer. His cancer eventually was diagnosed with lethal cancer. It was going to kill him and all. I think he tried to stay from the drugs as much as possible. I'm sure he took certain drugs to ease the pain and make his life comfortable. But he continued to write. He continued to speak. And then eventually he died a peaceful death in his home. Not with all tubes sticking out of his body, completely bald with a blown up body from chemotherapy. That was his choice, and it's a perfectly fine choice. But it was the disease that killed him. It wasn't his wife Edith saying, don't feed him, he's in a coma, don't feed him intravenously, we can't afford it, or something along those lines. But this is not really the thing that's in question. In fact, Geiger even says, from now on in this book, whenever I talk about what euthanasia is, I mean these other things. I don't mean this. Because when people are talking about legalized euthanasia, they're talking about all this stuff now. Active euthanasia or unnatural passive euthanasia rather than natural. One of the best questions they ask, and we're going to have some guidelines that I'm going to bring up next week when I go over the rest of this lecture on euthanasia and infanticide. By the way, infanticide is just one type of euthanasia, obviously. But one of the best questions to ask is, if we unplug this, what's going to kill this guy? Or what's going to kill this lady? Because that'll tell you a lot. If they're talking about, you know, she'll have a peaceful death. She'll probably die 2 or 3 weeks from now, lack of food. You know, there's all kinds of buzzers going to be going off. They're talking about killing this lady. But if we just unplug her and just let nature run its course, her disease is going to kill her. And it's irreversible. There's no way we can... All we can do is slow it down, which she's only got probably, you know, she could die in... I'm even wondering if the lady Yvonne, if they even did pull the plug, because they were talking about pulling the plug, and I realized it was the natural path of euthanasia. And they made a decision to pull it, and I think she died even before they pulled it, like about an hour before they were going to pull it. So, you know, that was just good professional judgment. They saw it was inevitable. Even if she's on the machine, she's going to die. Let's just allow it to run its course. But keep those distinctions in mind, and next week we'll pick it up from there and finish up the lecture on euthanasia.